You know the opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It has been about 25 years since a Committee of Privileges, or COP, report has been tabled in this House. When seen as a whole, the COP's processes and the report before Parliament leave many questions, gaps and omissions, and by extension suggests political partisanship. A key question is this: who did this House commit to the COP? Raisa Khan or the Workers' Party leadership? The COP did not appear to want to get to the bottom of why Ms. Khan lied in Parliament, nor why she had a propensity to lie with respect to her anecdote both in and out of this House. The fact that she had concocted a lie to bolster her anecdote in Parliament was not balanced against her evidence to the COP. What took centre stage instead was her uncorroborated testimony that she was instructed to take a lie to the grave by the Workers' Party leadership, a fabrication which never came out from any witness at the COP except Ms. Raisa Khan herself. I reject this finding completely. At no time did I instruct Ms. Khan to hide the truth. At the meeting on August the 8th, none of the three Workers' Party leaders told Ms. Khan to take a lie to the grave. I will speak on two main areas before concluding with a section on candidate selection in the Workers' Party. First, I will reflect on my judgment with respect to Ms. Khan's reasons for lying in Parliament, arising from my meeting with her on the 8th of August. Second, I will raise some broad points about the selective nature of how the COP report dealt with the evidence before it. However, as I intend to clear my name and cooperate with the public prosecutor, my comments on the COP report will be limited in scope. The most difficult aspect of this episode for me personally, and most certainly something that I have reflected on, is the approach to take when a fellow MP tells you, first, she is a rape victim, and second, how this episode caused an untruth to be told in Parliament. From the moment I learned, after the August sitting, that Ms. Khan had lied in Parliament, there was no doubt in my mind that she would have to confess in Parliament that she had lied, and that she would have to apologise for it in this House. I have shared publicly that the matter of the lie was something for Ms. Khan to explain in Parliament. My firm belief is that a Member of Parliament must be accountable in Parliament for what they say in Parliament. In addition, I consider that whenever she confessed, Ms. Khan would have to explain her reason for telling her lie. I did not want Ms. Khan's parents or loved ones to be caught by surprise before she had the chance to speak with them. Looking back, though, I gave Ms. Khan too much time to settle herself before closing the issue with her. Between the 8th of August and the 30th of September, I should have been proactive and checked where she was in addressing the matter with her family. That omission is mine alone. I acknowledge the same to the COP in my evidence. However, I will continue to be as sympathetic to anyone who shares such deeply personal details with me. My instinct, even today, would be to keep the information of the sexual assault to myself or to a very small group of trusted individuals, given its highly personal and sensitive nature. I would allow such a person space to deal with the matter. I still believe that it was right that the clarification was made in Parliament rather than out of it. That said, I will discuss with my party colleagues how, as an organisation and political party, we can handle such matters better while taking into account how delicate they are. So, on to my brief comments on the COP report. For today, the principal point I will make is the disregard of evidence I submitted to the committee. At minimum, I would have expected a listing of all the documents my fellow Workers' Party colleagues and I submitted to the committee to be included in the COP report, to indicate that they were actively considered in deliberations. I can only assume they were not considered, despite my colleagues and I being served with a summons to produce. There are objective documents that I submitted to the committee which raise serious doubts about the eventual findings reached in the report, including the unparliamentary language used at various places, which is not supported by evidence. The most egregious in my mind is the conclusion that in seeking a psychiatric evaluation for Ms. Khan, I had somehow weaponized her condition. The following points need to be considered as to why I mentioned the psychiatric evaluation. First, the notes of the Workers' Party Disciplinary Panel, or DP, which were submitted to the COP, show that Ms. Khan tendered on her own accord documents which revealed that she was the patient of a psychotherapist who had referred her to a psychiatrist. Second, on the 29th of November, Ms. Khan voluntarily shared with the DP that she suffered from dissociation. Once again, the relevant DP notes were forwarded to the COP. And third, I was asked an open question by the COP as to why Ms. Khan would make certain statements. I attempted to give a fair answer in line with what Ms. Khan herself had revealed. If the COP was indeed a fact-finding body, should I not have raised the matter of Ms. Khan possibly labouring under a condition to the COP? In my evidence to the COP, I registered the point that the matter was raised because it covered issues of proportionality and culpability. I believe that Ms. Khan should not be excessively punished for a condition she could be labouring under, and the COP ought to see it as a mitigatory point in her favour. This evidence of mine, supported by the COP's minutes of evidence on culpability and proportionality, is ignored by the COP. So I reject this assertion that in raising the matter of Ms. Khan's mental health to a fact-finding body with a view to consider an appropriate punishment, I had somehow smeared her, or worse, somehow cast aspersions on those with mental health conditions. Another point I strongly disagree with the COP on is how my evidence was characterized with regard to Ms. Lowe and Mr. Nathan's representations in antagonistic terms. I shared my view with the COP that, in my opinion, loyalty to Ms. Khan was an operative consideration on the minds of Ms. Lowe and Mr. Nathan. Ms. Khan, in her own WhatsApp text to me on the 22nd of November at Annex C-29, states that she would respect any decision the disciplinary panel makes, even if it is to resign. In my DP notes of the 25th of November covering the meeting with Ms. Lowe and Mr. Nathan, which again was submitted to the COP, Ms. Lowe made it clear that Ms. Khan's resignation should not be on the cards because, in her view, what she did in Parliament was not serious, and it was not as if Ms. Khan had, and I quote, laundered money, unquote. I believe many would take a different view that telling untruths in Parliament is serious. Such documentary evidence placed before the COP would show that I had good reasons for concluding that a loyalty to Ms. Khan was a consideration for her closest allies. Ms. Lowe's perspective of the gravity of what Ms. Khan did is one of those good reasons. Once again, such evidence does not appear to have been considered by the COP. I can only speculate why. Could it be to strategically drive a wedge and disunite the Workers' Party and show that its leaders recklessly cast aspersions on their own members? And in making the point, the COP report carefully omits the only character references I made in reference about Ms. Lowe and Mr. Nathan. And what did I say? I quote, that they are decent, good people and have done a lot for the party. I still hold that view. Finally, Mr. Speaker, the COP's case at its highest relies on one pillar. It believes Ms. Khan's evidence that she had been told to take a lie to the grave. This belief rests on an uncorroborated piece of evidence, a WhatsApp text originating from Ms. Khan herself. The COP deems the fact of its contemporaneousness to be critical in coming to its conclusion. The COP does not question Ms. Khan's credibility, even though she was the one who lied in this House by her own admission, and even though she also lied when she first communicated with me about the matter. So if contemporaneous evidence is indeed central, one would expect the COP report to exhibit a fidelity to such evidence. But it does not. For example, at para 93 of the report, it makes the case that Ms. Lowe was surprised the disciplinary panel was set up. And it advances Mr. Nathan's view that the DP was self-serving. However, what were Ms. Lowe and Mr. Nathan's contemporaneous views on the DP when it was set up? I submitted my WhatsApp text with both of them to the COP. Once again, this evidence is left out from the COP report. For the record, Ms. Low's contemporaneous reply upon receiving my message was, and I quote, "I see. Is there something you need me to do?" Unquote. Mr. Nathan's reply was clearer, and I quote, "Hi, Pritam. Noted on this. I know it's difficult, but I think party members and supporters will be comforted by it." Unquote. These contemporaneous WhatsApp messages directly contradict the COP's findings at para 93. This leaves me to consider Ms. Khan's behaviour after her resignation and her motivations for making her uncorroborated claim at the COP that she was told to take her lie to the grave. I would offer that the more natural explanation as to why she would do so that is in line is that it was in line with human behaviour, logic and common sense, to use the words of the COP. Her post-resignation behaviour was natural in the arena of political participation. When our first Prime Minister executed the transfer of power from the 1G to 2G leadership, according to five-time PAP MP for Whampoa, Mr. Augustine Tan, there was a lot of strain, tension and resentment when older MPs and ministers were told to step aside for the 2G PAP. In response, one outgoing minister even spoke against the candidature of PM Lee at the 1984 elections. Such was the level of disenchantment. The comparison with Ms. Khan's behaviour and testimony at the COP is apt because not everyone reacts with loyalty to their party or their party leaders when they realise that the curtain is coming down on them or their political careers. How did Toh Chin Chye, former Deputy Prime Minister and Chairman of the PAP, react when he was pushed to the backbench? He became a vocal critic of PAP policies and famously said, "How can I remain a dumb cow?" As to the handover of power, he said, and I quote, "For old party members who had been loyal, it was a painful process. You don't repay their loyalty by throwing them out. We had the responsibility to help them find jobs," unquote. In fact, so serious was the concern of the unhappiness among some members of the PAP old guard about political renewal that then Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, as Secretary General of the PAP, suggested to his Assistant Secretary General Goh Chok Tong to pack new cadre members into the People's Action Party in case the question of succession and renewal came to the fore at the next PAP party conference. Sir, for the record, there are no jobs for the boys or girls for ex-Workers' Party MPs. When your departure is precipitated by an overwhelming loss of support from your party members and colleagues, except for your closest allies, from a human behaviour standpoint, I can understand why a person would turn against one's party leaders. My final point, Mr. Speaker, is on the legitimate questions raised by Singaporeans about candidate selection in the Workers' Party. As this House knows, and as the government has also previously shared, for example, when the Chief of the Singapore Civil Defence Force was convicted in court, no selection process is foolproof and people can change. Even PAP MPs have been found guilty of criminal conduct or forced by their party to vacate their seats for other reasons. Potential PAP general election candidates have also been substituted at the 11th hour. The point is that even people who exhibit politically attractive character traits can turn out to be unsuitable. The Workers' Party also has had its fair share of the same experience. It can be very difficult, if not impossible, to test a person's judgment in all circumstances prior to fielding them as political candidates. This is so even for the PAP with its massive resources and far greater ease in finding willing candidates compared to opposition parties. However, the Workers' Party does not use these realities as an excuse. In the main, our candidate selection processes can always be better in spite of the extraordinary circumstances and the political culture of a one-party dominant state. I will confer with my colleagues with a view to fine-tune the processes in the Workers' Party as best we can, taking into account the structural challenges we in the opposition face. This would include the absolutely legitimate demands of Singaporeans that the Workers' Party fields individuals who do not lower the esteem of Parliament or who do not meet the standards expected of members of Parliament. Of course, I will endeavour to the best of my abilities to ensure that our candidates are rational, responsible and respectable. And if any candidate selection decisions are wrong, I, as Secretary General of the party, take full responsibility. In conclusion, with reference to the Leader of the House's first motion at 2C, the Workers' Party disagrees with the reasons behind the lower quantum of fine for Ms. Khan because it is predicated on alleged guidance given to her by myself, Ms. Lim, and Mr. Faisal, a case which the three of us reject. On the second motion, I am unable to accept the COP's findings that offences have been committed under the Parliament Act by me or any other Workers' Party MPs. Therefore, I will object to the second motion as the basis for the recommendations are that offences may have been committed by us. Nevertheless, should Parliament resolve to adopt the motion, I intend to clear my name and will cooperate fully with the public prosecutor. In view of this, I have kept my comments on the COP report for today's purposes very narrow and limited. Thank you.